This episode of Hubble Holding Up is brought to you by Luna's Llama Adventures.
What in the blue blazes is that, Steph?
Well, Andrew, I'm glad you asked. Luna's Llama Adventures is a new local company that offers you cute, cuddly llamas as trail companions, so you can trek through Humboldt's beautiful landscapes without having to carry your own stuff.
Now, that just sounds like a recipe for a winning nature selfie, if you ask me.
That's right. It's a very Insta-worthy, that's what the kids say these days, way to travel. So check them out at lunaslamaadventures.com. That's LUNASLLAMA adventures, in case you didn't know how to spell llamas.
There's two L's for some reason. It's crazy. It's Humble Holding Up, the podcast Humble County did not know that it needed and still doesn't know. My name's Andrew Goff.
And I'm Stephanie McGarry. Andrew, I'm podcasting from my bedroom.
Yeah, I think miraculously, this is the first time you've podcasted from your bedroom.
Bedroom is awesome. I like it. It's cozy. I'm here for it. But as soon as I'm feeling better, I'm ready to get back out there, Andrew. And I'm just wondering, do you, like I, miss the live theatra?
The theatra?
Yes, the theatra.
I like people pretending that they are somebody else for my enjoyment. And it's funny that you bring that up because, you know, today on the show, we have Michael Fields. Now, earlier this week, Michael put out the word that at the end of this month, he would be retiring after about 45 years as one of the main creative forces behind the Del Arte International School of Physical Theater out there in Blue Lake. And I think, Steph, we were talking earlier, you were saying that you went to a lot of Del Arte performances in your youth, yeah?
I did. I lived in Blue Lake for a time in the 90s. I definitely went to a lot of Del Arte shows back then, because that was like one of the main things you did in Blue Lake. But of course, even not living in Blue Lake, most of us go to Del Arte shows.
Now, see, I resisted. I resisted Del Arte for a long time because I was just like, oh, it's just, you know, this community theater thing out in Blue Lake. I was like, how it's a blue, what is it? I live, you know, I grew up in more the Eel River Valley scheme of things. And Blue Lake Blue Lake was a town that I passed on my way to Willow Creek when I was a kid. So I was like, how can there be theater out there? But then when I went there and saw, I can't remember what the first thing I saw out there was. Maybe they did a production of Tartuffe, I think. Mm-hmm. Maybe might have been the first thing, and I was like, oh my gosh, this is the production values are high, the acting is good, and Michael Fields has been a big part of that, and it's pretty remarkable actually. This guy has been doing this for 45 years, and Humboldt has said yes, please continue acting like a weirdo for our enjoyment, and he's carved out this kind of career in our little small rural county. That's pretty amazing. So I suspect he might have some things to tell us about how one does that.
I believe he has some tales to tell. So I'm very excited. Yeah. Let's get Michael in here. And
Michael.
Morning. M. Fields is connected to audio.
Indeed, I'm connected to audio.
Okay, cool.
Right. That's a great start.
Yeah.
Are you coming to us from Blue Lake?
I'm coming to you from my house, which is between Blue Lake and Arcata on Warren Creek Road. So I look down on the Mad River from my house.
Okay.
I've lived here a long time.
Wow.
It's not a mansion, but it is.
Okay.
And it's eight-sided, but it's not a yurt either.
Wow. Yeah, that is. I love it over there. That's one of my favorite. I love
living here. Yeah.
Favorite spots to go to, the river. It's just over some of the holes at Warren Creek.
Yeah. I think as far as like places in Humboldt that you can classify as magical, you know, that zone right there seems to have high magicalness levels. That
I
must be
walk
rough.
Down my road and I'm the only one on my driveway and cross it. And my neighbor plowed a path down to the river, crosses his land, but neighbors can walk it. So yeah. I can take my dog down there and walk on the river, go in the river. It's beautiful. It's just beautiful. I love it here.
Yeah. How much of your life these days is kind of like the, you know, solitude in nature? Like how much does that play a part in your, you know, life
well,
and process?
It's
and...
more certainly than it ever was before. Yeah. You know, I got a, as many people did, I got a puppy when, cause I figured I'd be home more and I could take care of it. That was my, I've always had dogs and I love them. And I just, so we got a rescue at 8 weeks old and she was this little cute fluff ball. And now she's 80 pounds of mutt. McNabb, lab, Great Dane, they say, the vet says, God knows she's beautiful, yeah. Sweet, but huge. Right.
Yeah. Okay. So
that's kept me both walking more and, you know, more not having to go into an office every day. I'm sure.
Yeah.
Sure. You guys too haven't been, I haven't been going into to Del Arte and Blue Lake.
Yeah. Well, we've just kind of started coming back more regularly here. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So,
but as far as pandemics go, living in Humboldt is a pretty good situation to find yourself in.
It's a great situation to find yourself in.
Yeah. Well, yeah. So we want to, you know, thank you for doing this and, sure, I guess we'll jump into this, you know, like, so you've put out, the word, Michael, that you are going to be, you know, retiring from Del Arte after some 45 years as as an actor and a teacher and a director and an administrator. And for me, that is an unthinkable number of years of a community saying, like, hey, we like watching you work and play for our enjoyment. How does it feel to be making this transition?
It's bittersweet, I got to say. You know, I mean, hopefully, but I don't want to predetermine this. There will be some opportunities to teach and create still in Blue Lake going forward. But that should be the choice of new people, new leadership. There's been talk of a founders board with Jane Hill, Joan, Shirley, and I, to be able to be that. So there'll be an association there. But I think there's two things that in terms of feeling. One is that there needs to be a next generation stepping into this. And that's, you know, many, many years ago, we had a decision to make. This is Joan and Donald and I and whoever else was on the admin team, whether Del Arte would survive us or not. Yeah. You know, it's whether you create an institution or whether you create that it lives. And I know many theater companies that went down with the founders and it was fine. You know what I mean? That was the choice they made. So we made the choice that it continue. And once you make that choice, then you put in another set of prerogatives come into play about what needs to happen going forward. So it's not been something that has not, it's like a surprise. And for me, I took this whole year. I mean, it really was announced to the organization a year ago that this was going to happen so that there was a way for, to pass stuff on. You know, I think, one of the things I wrote for, I've written a lot of stuff recently about how do you become an elder? How do you become, I'm a young elder. I'm not old yet. Mm-hmm. I thankfully have most of my facilities. So, you know, how do you become an elder in that way in how you pass things on and when to step forward and when to step back and all of that. And then part of it for me is starting this new venture so that I can keep creating work that I feel should happen now. You know, as you get older, that you feel the pressure of time a bit more. And that means time. I have a lot of ideas for things to make. So how do you keep making them in a timely way?
Well, we definitely, sorry. I was going to say, we definitely want to talk more about your next venture too. Uh-huh. But something else that we like to do on these things is kind of get what we call people's Humboldt story. Uh-huh. And, you know, you've been a part of Del Arte for 45 years. We thought maybe, could you just tell us a little bit about, you know, how you came to be a part of Del Arte and how did you land in Humboldt? And just that whole tale.
Well, I came here when I was 21. Carlo and Jane had set up the Grand Comedy Festival, which is a College of the Redwoods, and it was a summer stock. And I was a student at the University of San Francisco, and one of my mentors was directing for that festival. So he invited me to come up here as an actor. And the first, I've told this story probably too many times, but the first 5 minutes I was in Blue Lake, I was in a fight in Walt's Friendly Tavern. And I got out of the car. I'd never been to Blue Lake before. And everybody says, let's go have a beer. And, you know, there's three bars in Blue Lake at that point. There was the Lager Waltz and the Mad River Rose. We went into Waltz and some guy said, dance with my wife. And I said, no. And we had what I'm going to call a good old boy fight, where you grab each other and beat each other on the back like this. No one gets hurt, really. Glasses break, tables fall. You don't get hurt.
We seem to have lost this tradition. I don't know that I've seen a good old boy fight.
So we
bring it back.
And afterwards, he says to me, now we're friends for life. So flash forward about 20 years, I see him in a blogger on St. Patrick's Day. And he said, my hair used to be dark, of course. And he said, what happened to your hair? And I said, turned white. What happened to your teeth? And you could see that flash of wanting to go back in again. No, yeah. But so I came up to do the Grand Comedy Festival, and I did it 2 years, two summers. And then the summer after that very fall, I think Del Arte had gotten a grant to do Loon's Rage, which was actually very, talk about foresight, you know, it was a juxtaposition of Native American mythological story characters like Coyote, Crow, Raven, with the Commedia characters, Arlecchino, Brighella, and there is, and Carlo was fascinated by this connection. So there was an NEA grant, of course there was a grant, to seed this project. And that was where Joan and I'd worked together in the summer festival, but we worked together in the thing of the touring company. And Donald came a couple of years later. And that's another whole funny story, because the first time I met Donald, he tried to pick up my then girlfriend in San Francisco in a juggling act. And I had to, so I get up in Donald's face. And then 2 years later, Jail, who was directing our work, says, here's the new actor. It's Donald sitting in a doorway in 2 Street with a bottle of beer. And I thought, oh, this is never going to work. And we're like the best friends, right? So it's like, of course it works. But it was it was tough in Blue Lake in the day.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I was real quick, like what year was this? There's all these formative years.
I came here in
1975
for the Grand Comedy Festival, came back in 76. And the first company show was 77. You remember CETA grants? Maybe not. It was California Employment Training Act, CETA. It basically funded us as individuals for about a year and a half, almost 2 years. We were funded to do work. So probably 79 to 81, we ended up creating a ton of shows because we were on salary. And we knew that would end, So once it ended, then we had a lot of material to tour. And then we really got into the touring world.
So, 45 years that you've been there, that's a huge amount of time for plenty of failures and successes. What are some aspects of Del Arte, productions or programs y'all developed that you're most proud of? Does any period stand out as like, that was the golden era?
I think the heyday of touring, Andrew, I was literally on the road 6 months a year. And it wasn't fancy touring. This isn't like the Hilton and this is like sleeping on people's floors. But we played, it did two things. One, we were able to develop original work here in Humboldt, play it in a rural circuit and develop it with the audience's response and feedback to it before we took it into the cities, where you're going to meet the critics hard, and so a lot of our work was really developed by the time it hit urban areas. Yeah. And we had a great connection, of course, with San Francisco and Los Angeles, because they're the biggest urban cities next to us. So those were, but that era of, the late 70s to, that was the beginning of the Scar Tissue Mysteries. Joan created the character Scar Tissue. There were 4 of those plays. And then we hit the 90s, and this happened. The 90s is when Donald and I both had kids. And once that happens, you stop wanting to be on the road.
Yeah.
And you want to be home. So that's when the festival really kicked in, is in the beginning of that era, where, because it became a forum format where we could create, that was with the Corbell cycles, which I think to this day are still some of the best, some of the best place-based work that we ever did was the Corbells. And there were like six of them.
Now, obviously I'm too young to remember them, but I came out and saw Blue Lake, the musical and stuff like that. And that is a very interesting aspect of what y'all do, is that you're making art for a very specific place and, with not a huge population. You know, I think a lot of places might not see through work like that because it is such a niche audience. Like, can you talk a little bit about the Corbell series you're talking about?
Sure. And I'm going to frame it with this is, I have some Irish roots in me. My daughter went to Trinity College in Dublin and now is with an Irish boyfriend who I like a lot. So, but Lady Gregory, was one of the founders of the Abbey Theatre in Dublin back in early 1900s. And somebody asked her, if your plays are so much about provincial Ireland, who's going to care? And she said that she talked about this great Irish poet that would listen on his back steps to what was being said in the neighborhood and then shout it to the four corners of the world. And I think that that's an aspect of this. So Mills were started in the 90s when the Mills, there was the whole environmental movement really ramped up, but at the same time, the Mills started to automate. So they started to lay people off because they didn't need the same number of workers. So it was blamed on environmentalists, but that wasn't the whole case, as so many of these things are, right? So we saw in Blue Lake a lot of people who were really traditional logging families having an inordinately horrible time being able to make ends meet. And their pride and their sense of who they were was completely bashed in by this. So we wrote, this is fictional, although it's based on some real people. But we wrote a piece, the first Corbell was based on it was called The Funeral, and it was Dorothy Dugan's funeral, the matriarch of the family. She had committed suicide by sticking her head in a microwave, which is not possible, but that was how she couldn't pay her electric bill. She couldn't pay her PG&E bill. And then she had two sons. I played one, Donald played the other. The one I played had an amazing number of logging accidents and was missing various parts of his body from these accidents. And Donald played a Vietnam vet, what did he call it? A transvestite lesbian. So he was dressed in women's clothes and no one knew who he was in the funeral until this big reveal. And then we would go into flashbacks and like Tommy, the character I play, couldn't say the word welfare. He would stutter, cause he'd have to go on blah, 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 so no one could say these, words, but the event was a funeral and we had a huge amount of community people in it, who would speak as you would at a funeral, for somebody. Yeah. And then the next year we did the wedding and we used to go to this place to write plays up Forks near Flat Salmon. Malcolm Terrence and Susan Terrence have a place up there. And even then we wanted to get away from phones. We wanted to get away from all elect so we could focus in and get off the grid and write. Wow. So I was making a fire in their stove and I came across the Siskiyou News and they were writing about the unorganized Siskiyou militia. This was around the time of the bombing in Oklahoma City. So we created the Southern Corbell Unorganized Militia named SCUM, which was very active. They plugged up the toilets at the courthouse. They were like your normal right wing militia of the day. And Tommy, of course, again, the character I played, was involved in it. And this was the best ending of a play ever. we had a, what a shill is, right? Somebody who you plant in the audience to do something for you.
Sure, yeah.
So we had somebody we had an 8-year-old boy planted in the audience. And at the end of this play, the FBI is looking for Tommy. And so they rappel off the roof of the amphitheater, literally like mountaineering equipment with guns and bullhorns and FBI outfits. And they say, we're the FBI, give us Tommy Dugan. There's silence. this little kid stands up and he says, "I'm Tommy Dugan. I'm from Corbell." And audience members, unprovoked, every show would stand up and say, "I'm Tommy Dugan. I'm from Corbell." That, wow. That ending was so powerful, right? Because community comes to stands together for one of their own, basically. And so we did then, there was the wedding, there was the birth where we had more shills in the audience, this time with water balloons. There hadn't been any births in Corbell for many years. And Dorothy Dugan, this mother that keeps coming back from the dead and making things happen. So she came back from the dead and made people spontaneously give birth. And water broke everywhere in the audience. Babies were born at the end of the show. And then that we did, I wrote one which got me into a lot of trouble, which I guess, remember, were you around when the police chief in Blue Lake? He had more armaments. He had like he was armed to the teeth down there.
Maybe you should tell the context. So
I don't remember his name, but he
Gunderson was the
police chief. And so Blue Lake had a helicopter. And we had all these weapons down there, and it was when there was a police chief, not a sheriff's, which we have now. But I wrote a piece about a traffic accident between an ambulance and a taco truck was involved, so people came in, and the casino was set up like a casino and a hospital, so you could get heart surgery and gamble at the same time. So that was the premise, but there was only enough machines to keep five people, and we had six. So Donald's character ends up dying in this. They all have this accident and all end up in this hospital. Once again, Joan comes back as Dorothy and takes her son up to heaven with her. So there's been a series. Lauren Wilson wrote a great one a few years ago, the last one where
Why did you get in trouble? You said you got in trouble.
Because the police chief got mad.
He got me.
Mad, and I was sitting at Los Bagels on a Monday, which is the actor's day off, right? And my kids are with me and they're little, and they love Los Bagels. They're having their coffee and their slug. And we were sitting outside, and I forget what newspaper it was, maybe the Journal, I don't know. And in it, the police chief said, "Del Arte's just a havoc on the city of Blue Lake."
Oh,
what the hell is this? And my daughter turns to me and says, in Danish, "Dad is fa, like your fa." So she says, "Fa, please." But I pick up my phone and I call the guy. And I say, you got to retract this. Because you're basically knifing your own community in the back, you know? Yeah. And then I knew that there would be retribution, which there was. He tried, you know, we have a sound, you know, what do you call it? An ordinance where you can't play amplified music after 10 o'clock in Blue Lake at night.
Yeah.
Which we honor. We're very religious with that. So but he came out and tried to arrest our technician for growing marijuana, and he ran into the logger, and everybody locked the doors from the inside and wouldn't let the cops into the logger. So it was a scene, but he got mad, and he got mad at me,
if I recall, it didn't end up well for him, and ultimately,
he got busted for, I think, some sexual assault
some unsavory things.
Some unsavory things. So it was not a pleasant end for him, I don't
think. So consider the source. When he says that you are the ones causing havoc on Blue Lake, I would beg to differ, maybe.
But, you know, series like that, when maybe there'll be another one sometime in the future, I don't know. But you're right about the theater of place thing. It doesn't exist very many places in this world.
Yeah. Well, and I was thinking, too, like you talk about, you know, crafting this theater around people's very real hardships, but also making it funny and, like, you know, and identifying with their plight. Like, what's it like to, you know, you do a show like that and then you go into the lager bar afterwards and you're face to face with these people? Like, what do they say about the art that you're creating that's based on their lives?
They loved it. They loved it. I based a character in this guy, Smitty. I don't know if you know what pulling green chain is, but green chain is one of the most dangerous jobs in logging.
That's how you lose Smitty, fingers. Yeah.
Fingers, heads, everything. You know, you wrap a chain around a tree and they jerk it up the hill.
Yeah.
And you have to get out of the way, you know? So Smitty had his helmet on the wall at the logger. It has a big dent in it. And so when Smitty talked, he didn't, I couldn't ever really understand what he said. He would go, you know what I mean? We had great conversations. If you can believe it, he would come see every play and just rave. I think when you see yourself, we're not doing imitations of people, but when you see, you know, yourself represented on stage, it's a powerful thing because there's a voice there then. Right. And we're not making fun of you. You know, you people may laugh because the situations are funny, but our goal is to embody these people, not to make fun of them.
You know? Right.
Yeah.
And let me ask, like, we've talked about some of the things that you think have gone well over the years. Can you think of some projects that Del Arte has undertaken that maybe sucked?
Oh, sure. I mean,
or that just were just like, oops, we didn't do that right.
Well, play failures, we've had several, you know. We invited one of the first iterations of the Mad River Festival, we invited communities. There's a poison oak club over in Willow Creek. And they did a play about being infiltrated by the FBI, which I guess happened, this poison oak, this real thing. So these groups of community people are coming and doing these relatively amateur productions. And in the festival, and we let them camp in the backyard, which we couldn't now, but we did then.
Okay.
And was Willow Creek, Sawyer's Bar, and some other.
A hotbed of theater.
Yeah. A hotbed of theater. Yeah, there's a theater company in Salyer out there.
Oh, I didn't know about that. I know about the Willow Creek one.
East of Willow Creek out there. So they all came and did a piece, and they were all sleeping there, and across. Above where the cafe used to be, which you can see into the amphitheater, there used to be this big Confederate flag in the window. This is a rental unit up there, right?
Okay, true.
And in the morning, these guys turned their their big speakers to the windows and cranked up some horrific music and then yelled out the window, "Wake up, you puppet makers." And I think that was the first time maybe we'd had recognition from that aspect of the community. We don't make puppets. So this they got that wrong. But I think that, you know, one of the big things was getting the community, you know, to accept the fact that there's really this eccentric kind of off the wall, you know, school in the middle of your town.
Yeah.
And there was some major... A woman named Joe Mankin was in our company for a while. She died a couple of years ago. She is a phenomenal actress, Bay Area based. We were doing a play called, I forget what it was called, but we were in the Carlo. It was late at night, you know, and some people tried to break in and steal tools from the backstage while we're in the theater. So we chased them out into the street, caught one of them. And the next day it was like West Side Story. There was a gang of like, I don't know, seven or eight, between 18 to 24 year old guys coming down the street. And Donald and I and Joan Mankin and our stage manager at the time was Keld Light, who was a local director. Keld is really tiny, but wiry and a vet. These guys standing on the street. Why do guys do this? Keld tore his shirt off. That's the first thing. I've seen this in a million bar. Why do people do this? I don't know. But Kel does this, and Joan Mankin is a black belt in something. Spin kicks and knocks one of these people out within the first like 5 seconds. Yeah. That stopped all vandalism at Del Arte for a decade.
Man. I didn't know this was just going to be like a history of Blue Lake fights.
I was just going to say, it's like,
I'm sorry. I should make Blue Lake to be invited. It's a very
I never realized you're definitely painting a very like rough and tumble picture.
Oh, it was in the day.
Seems like it kind of was, but now, like you're saying, you know, when the community eventually embraced Del Arte, it's now become such a central part of the community, and now Yeah.
And part of that comes from the work that the organization did in Blue Lake School, the school program in Blue Lake School, because we used to have the eighth grade do a piece in our theater, which meant the parents came to watch their kids,
which
is often the first time anybody been in the theater. And, you know, I think sometimes people think of a theater the way you think of a church. It's a, how do I behave in there? What is the rituals? What is it? It's not a particularly, because we're in it all the time. It seems like a comfortable space, but I don't think that's true for everyone, which is why the amphitheater is so great for the festival, because you're outside.
Yeah.
You can sit on the lawn. You can be.
Yeah. When was it that you started doing the school productions?
With the schools?
Yeah.
Back in the late 80s, I would say, through the 90s.
Yeah.
And that made a huge difference in the relationship of the community.
Yeah, that's interesting to hear.
Because I had, in the training, if you walk down the street, sometimes you hear people screaming, you know, upstairs in the studios as part of the training for the adult students. And some woman came in the office one day and she said, "Can you show me the room you worship the devil in?" And I said, "Well,
it's all the rooms,
right? This way, yeah,
right, exactly. We're all in there." No, so you know, there's a lot of wonder, I think, about what goes on over time, and it's a learning curve. I mean, and we had to be accepted in you know, I'm a pretty good pool player, and I the logger in that respect too. And I'm not the best, believe me, but it's how you. When they see that you are really part of the community, not trying to be separate from it or better than it, we're just looking to live there. This is where we live. So, and I think that is something that other theaters have been trying to do forever, and we just did it because we had to.
They picked fights with you, and then you had to hold your own in the fight, in the brawl, and you literally brawled your way into Blue Lake's hearts. So.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. Okay, Goff, so you live in Humboldt, right?
That's true.
So you know that you're like legally required to enjoy hiking. Right.
I know that I can face prison time if I don't go on hikes regularly. Yes.
That is just a fact. That's a fact. But have you ever gone hiking with a llama?
No. What am I doing with my life?
Well, you know, you can do that now by booking a tour with Luna's Llama Adventures and reserve a llama trek for a day, 2 days or more. They also even offer shorter llama visits for your special events. It's amazing.
That is legitimately amazing.
Yeah. So visit lunasllamaadventures.com for more information and to book your amazing llama encounter today.
So.
Yeah. Well, you know, I grew up, I spent a little bit of time in Blue Lake when I was a kid. It would have been like the late 90s. And when you were talking a little bit, I guess my own view would be biased, but I definitely think of that as a golden era of Del Arte. I mean, I just remember, the Mad River Festival and like Los Payasos Mendigos was a thing. The best. Yeah.
They were the best. Yeah.
Yeah.
But that wasn't, you know, it's sometimes you get lucky in this work. And we got a grant from the Lila Wallace Foundation for like $400,000. And I was able to actually, for the first time, have a marketing budget for the festival. Mm. Funny when you put it out there that it's happening, people, and it's, but we didn't have the resources to do that. And then you slowly get on, you know, when we did, names of plays, the one about the wild card, when we went about the building of the casino.
That's what it was called. We were trying to think of it earlier.
And I wrote that with the support and the advice of Arlo Ramsey, who was a charitable woman at that time.
Okay.
Still around.
But we had Keat do a documentary on it, and they filmed. This is the coolest shot. We did an airplane shot, so they flew over the amphitheater, you know, at night during the closing of the show, and they focused the camera down on the stage from above, and you see this bright light of the stage and all the audience, and it was a pretty good audience. And then they panned up with the camera like this, and you see Del Arte's lights shrink and the casino lights get huge.
Yeah.
Which is really, you know, that we really were interested in exploring people's fear of a casino coming in, which was real.
Yeah.
A lot of people were worried what it would do, what it would bring. I think a lot of that's been unfounded in some respect, but it was real. You know, people really had these thoughts and ideas. So to do plays like that, I think are, and Arla and I got, this is another time I got into trouble because there was a song in the play called "There Are No Indians in This Play." and it was a fun song, but it was sung from the perspective of, you know, I talked to Arla about Native actors and which it's not part of their, you know, that tradition. So we put this song in as a way of saying, not that we tried, that this is just the fact of what's going on right here. And so Arla and I went back to Flint, Michigan for some conference on democracy, animating democracy. And she's a really articulate speaker and gave a beautiful presentation. But, you know, it's funny how people want to respond to things like that without knowing anything about where you are, or especially where you are.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But here's the flip side of that. We go to LA in like 81 with the first scar tissue piece, Intrigue at APA, which was about the fish wars up on the Klamath. They had a fish court. They had a court that only dealt with Native American fishing violations, which to me is like, how unconstitutional can you get? But the, so this piece has got, it's a little agitproppy, it's a little, but it's funny. And we're all in our prime. I mean, we all look good, I gotta say. See, we look good. We're handsome, sexy guys. And we go into LA, and we do what's called a split week. So we're in this 99-seat theater. We do the play for two nights. We go to San Diego on the Wednesday to do a gig at a college to make some money. We go back and finish out the next weekend in LA. I'm sleeping on the floor of a friend's house in LA. And she says, "Hey, have you read the paper?" I said, "No." She gives me the LA Times. And on the front of the calendar, this is the Friday LA Times, front of the calendar section, it says, "Go see this play." We get a rave from the LA Times. They sold out 6 weeks, 8 shows a week in 3 hours.
Wow.
And now we're in LA with agents. And I see Johnny Carson in the front row one night. You know what I mean? It's all of this. And we get... then the local press up here picks it up, and now we're okay locally because we made it in LA.
So do you think, like, you know, this success and this life and this story you've been able to live is repeatable? Because I think, like, this idea of Humboldt as a kind of like magnet for artistically minded people is a story we seem to be fine telling ourselves. And so I wonder what you would tell young people now who are trying to carve out a fun life and world for themselves. Like, I'll try framing it like this. Like, do you think that the current conditions, say in America at large, or maybe specifically in Humboldt, make it easier or harder for someone creative to start something like Del Arte and have it be successful enough that you can seek out a living doing what you love, like you have?
Well, it's a really great question. I mean, I'm going to answer it just personally. Honestly, I think it's harder right now. And I say that from the perspective of being a, you know, mid 60-year-old person, in the sense that what I didn't know helped me a lot.
Yeah.
I'm basically autodidactic learning. You learn by doing, but I didn't have any preconceived notions of what something should look like, you know, should be. So there's a freedom in that, I think. And we made some, you know, like buying the building, that's ambitious. It is something that if you're really looking at it, probably isn't pragmatic, but worked, thank God. But it was, you know, those kind of choices. I also think that we're in a period of enormous change in terms of, Well, you see it in the theater world. I'll speak to the theater world, in the racial equity questions, in financial, how to survive questions, what people will feel comfortable with coming back to the theater. Will they feel comfortable sitting next to strangers in rather relative close proximity? I mean, those are questions I can't answer, but I think it will be different. I just don't know how. And I'm not envious of those who are trying to either navigate or help figure out this difference, because the racial equity work, which we've been deeply engaged in at Del Arte in a very good way, is a lens and a practice you apply to the work. It isn't the work, if you know what I mean. And and I think in some places it becomes the work instead of the practice that you apply when you're creating or when you're teaching or how, and to keep that kind of centered is not an easy thing either. Because there's so much to do. There's so much to do in all of this, you know, and how you keep, we've been funded by this community, and I'm very grateful for that. I mean, but we see an aging community here. We see a lot of boomers here like me, you know, I'm in the end of the baby boom. And I love when the students, when I can say it's the boomer here, you know, but it's that perspective, and it's changing. Will a new generation do with this? I honestly
don't know. Since you know, brought it up, you know, talking about how things have changed, and especially in this last year, you know, where we've seen this sort of period of great social reckoning and calls for individuals and organizations to sort of reexamine their power structures and focus on racial equity. You know, about a year ago, Del Arte had a pretty public discussion about this after a group of people sort of called out the organization for its practices. And, you know, I mean, what are some of the concrete steps that Del Arte has been taking to address racial equity? And, you know, as what have you felt has been your role in this, you know, as a leader in that organization?
That's a great question, too. We did respond to the letter, and because anytime you get a call out, a public call out like that, it makes you look at everything, right? You have to look at everything. And and thankfully, we didn't go down a defensive or rabbit hole way of approaching it. So we asked around for people who could lead us through both a training for ourselves and a way of looking at our practices and how we operate. You know, the whole phrase there's a lot of phrases now, but the white supremacy culture, that aspect of it, when you look at that, and we did that. We found a gentleman named Isaac Carter. He's got his PhD, so it's Dr. Isaac Carter. He's in Miami, but he has a connection to Humboldt. He was worked at HSU for a few years. His son is an alumni of HSU. So he knows this community, which I found. I mean, so that was the first step, is to find someone who could lay out a plan and help guide us. And then the second part of it is to really go. So we did a racial equity audit with our community. We surveyed a lot of stuff to get a sense of both staff, the nine who wrote the letter, they're all included in this, to get that kind of direct feedback from people. And we're starting on I hate to say the word strategic plan. It's such a looking at, you know what I mean? I don't know why I don't like that word, but I don't.
But I know what you mean, because everybody is doing.
It sounds buzzwordy, but
yeah. And that's why I said,
but it's accurate. Yeah.
Yeah. But people want to hear the concrete, so steps.
It's like looking forward to what the organization, we're almost 50. So what does it look like for the next 50 years? What kinds of things, you know? And so you've probably read in the news that we ceased the MFA program for a couple of years, put it on a pause basically. And that's because it was not financially sustainable the way it is now. Unlike a college, we don't get money from the state of California or the feds. So in that respect, and we don't have an endowment. So when things like a pandemic hit, then there's this added pressure, because we couldn't run a school during the pandemic. I mean, we have five students who will graduate on Sunday, MFA 3 class. That's it for now. So it's, I think the racial equity work is essential. And in the theater world, it's hugely essential. Because there's been a lot of, I saw a great meme on Facebook. It made me laugh. It said, 2020, we're looking at ourselves in racial equity work. 2021, we're going to open the season with Greece. You know, it's the antithesis of what you're looking at. So a very concrete step is the festival's being renamed the Badawat Festival Mad River. Mm-hmm. And that's not a gratuitous, it's done with the full permission and blessing of the Wiat tribe. But it is a way of putting the Wiat language in our conversations, you know, bring it to the fore and to recognize that we're on Wiat land. So those things, you know, we're not trying to do symbolic things, but actually things that change practice and how we look at things and change. Maybe the nature of the work itself will change. I don't know how that will be. I don't think anybody can say, oh, it'll be this next year. I don't see anybody being able to articulate that.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned, you know, the changing the name of the Mad River Festival to the Badawat Festival, you know, not necessarily being a performative action, because Del Arte has had a relationship with the tribe for some years now. Like, can you talk a little bit about what that has looked like and how that relationship has influenced what Del Arte has done?
We went out to, we do something called rural residencies with our first year students, where they camp and live in a community for 10 days. And these have been all over, but for the last maybe 5 or 6 years, Table Bluff and the Wiat Tribal Center has been one of those places.
Yeah.
And that way that community gets to know the students get to know that community. They make a work together. It's very fun, with usually younger people. And it's hysterical. It's really, and we do this with all kinds of different communities up here. We've been up to Orleans, to Hoopah, what's the one, not Hay Fork, but the one down south. Anyway, we've done a lot of these and they become one of them that we did one of the coolest, I think. Willard Carlson lives at Apa Creek where it hits the Klamath off the grid. And he is building a healing center for Native Americans with a sweat lodge with a, it's completely off the grid.
Yeah.
We took all of our students not to do theater, but to help him build under his direction, clear land, build stuff, be on the river, listen to the stories that they had to tell. And for our international students, it just changes their world, right? Yeah. Because their image and what this means is so different when you actually are, and when you're in that place, you know, there's no cell phone. There's no computer. There's your miles off a grid. It is a completely different space to be. And the students have to camp and they have to, you know, we have tents. We have all this stuff. They have to go do all this themselves and deal with each other in a different way than being, creating theater work together. But a lot of our work, I mean, from the time we started, we've been engaged with different Native American communities and artists, you know, Julian Lang, who's a great artist up here, and Lynn Risling. We got a grant to do a piece called Original Instructions, Stories of Creation. And Julian and Lynn's daughter did one called All in the Kurukh Language. Julian spoke it in Kurukh. Donald and I and Joan wore masks and were not allowed to speak, which for Donald was very hard. And then we had a Mark Izu, who's a Japanese American, brilliant musician, plays ancient instruments like the sho and the shun, and composed all this music for it. And it was a phenomenal. It was a coming of age story. Lynn's daughter was coming of age, so that was the story. It was so powerful.
Nice.
And it's, and it goes beyond like doing a show. You are essentially, the collaboration is, Julian said, we're getting ready to go on stage. And Julian is like pale white, like just, you know, and I understand. I get nervous to this day when I go on stage. I get nervous. And I said, it's okay. He says, no, you don't understand. You see, we're looking out and we can see the audience. He says, see the front row? Those are the elders. It's not the same for you as it is for me. And it was a powerful, you learn so much, right, about where you are and things from these. But these collaborations, I often use the word collaborations, when people work together and there's virtually no, you know, there's no seeking of what, how do I serve this, not how do, you know.
It's a fun puzzle.
That's been our focus a ton over, well, 40 years. So it isn't, this isn't a new thing.
Yeah.
But it is, in, I think it's an ongoing, genuine relationship that you hope to build with different facets of the community.
Hmm. Yeah. Well, so speaking about Bottawa Festival, and of course, you know, we're excited to see live theater and events like this returning. You'll be sort of premiering your first production with your new production company as a part of it, I believe.
Yes, indeed. You are right.
And so this new production company of yours called
Long Shatter.
Okay, we weren't exactly sure how to pronounce it. It seems like it's an interesting story of the,
no
of the
name.
No? Yeah. Okay.
Not yet.
Yeah, it's early. It's early.
Yeah.
So which Blue Lake Brawl story led to the name?
You know, here's the thing on well, first Long Shatter and then the piece itself. The Long Shatter was a sign on my driveway because I live on the side of a steep hill overlooking the Mad. And in the winter, I only get shadows because the sun does that arc and it goes behind. You don't get sun now.
Right.
Beautiful. So somebody named it that. And for me, the whole metaphor of coming into light, you know, getting back to the light was why I named it that. The piece, I've had this idea for a while to do a, and as you get older, you also start thinking about these things in a different way. So again, it's, I talk about theater place. It's responding first. It's personal to me because, you know, I had a couple little medical incidents. This is the funniest one. It's not funny. Well, it is funny. it's all funny if you look at it through that lens.
I'll judge it whether this is funny or not.
Okay. Yeah.
I had a, so I was supposed to go to New York about in like 2019, January. Go to New York, and was going to speak at this event in New York because I used to be president of the International Theater Institute for this country, which meant that it's like the UN of theater, right? And I was supposed to go, and so I'm thinking about this. I have to think about what I'm going to say. I have to think, you know, the to-do list that goes through your head when you're trying to get out of town, right? Mm-hmm. So it's Sunday night. We're leaving Wednesday morning really early, hoping the flights get in, you know, all that, the worry that comes with travel here. And I go to bed Sunday night, and I sleep through an entire day, like all the way to the next night. And my wife comes home and shakes me awake and says, we go to the hospital. I'd had a sleep stroke. I didn't know such things existed. And they do I'd never had an MRI. I'd never had any of these things. And I go to Mad River and it's like, be our guest. I'm the only one in there. Everybody knows your name. I love the Mad River folks. But it was scary. You know, I didn't lose any facility. My balance was for crap for about 2 months and I couldn't see straight. So I wasn't driving. Thank you. People drove me places, but I had this incredible thing. Lenny, my wife, took me to a meeting somewhere in Arcata and I literally did a forward roll over a newly planted rose bush on somebody's front lawn. Now I'm a big boy. That rose bush is dead. You know what I mean? But when I went over it, I came right back up on my feet and nobody taped it. Nobody saw it. It was the best forward roll I've done in 30 years.
Lost to history. Yeah.
Lost to history now. But I think when you go through something like that, you know, you have a different sense of, or I have, speak personally, a sense of mortality, and that these, you know, who knew that these things happened and or could happen, you know? So it was a little bit of a wake up that way. And I have always been interested in, you know, people tend to think when you get over 60, you can't have passionate love anymore. Well, not true. Just saying that. So all right. This idea of doing Midsummer with all the lovers over 60 to me was right. Just, and then the pandemic, and I thought, well, nursing homes, and what does that mean? And to have the staffs who are all working for minimum wage in these places where all these people are dying, you know. So that became, to make that funny. So this summer is a jukebox musical, which is this. It's where you hear, you know how you hear music on a jukebox and you go, I've heard that song. But you may not remember exactly where, but it's familiar. So we're going to try a bunch of songs out this summer. It's a concert. Mm-hmm. And you probably, neither one of you know the M&M Club or remember the M&M Club.
Is it this a local thing?
Yeah, it was right near Murphy's Market on Glendale. Okay. As you come back the back road from Blue Lake to Ada. And it was It was more of a dive than the Lager. It burned down. It's not there anymore. But The M&M Club, Donald and I lived in Fieldbrook. We shared a house. And so on our way home from rehearsals, we'd stop at the M&M Club for one. And we go and
just once.
And it was country. It was old Humboldt, where, you know, the jukebox is full of country songs and it's playing and people are crying with the music, the bartender showing us his new guns, because there was always a new gun. it was an incredible place. And again, to go in there as actors, and we were definitely the outliers.
Yeah.
They loved us in it, because I'm not afraid of the M&M Club. So it was great. But some of the music I heard in there, I'm singing an Alan Jackson song this summer called The Older I Get. And I'm singing a Steamboat Willie piece called I Don't Look Good Naked Anymore. And it's, but we have about 18 songs. There's some originals from Jeff Kelly and Tim Randles, and there's some classics. But it's a way to see about the musical side of it, which I thought might be good now, because it will be fun and there'll be some good songs and the band is killer. So yeah, all that.
All right. Mm. So and is this the kind of thing that we can expect more of moving forward with Long Shatters? There's gonna be a lot of old people.
Well, not necessarily all old people. Here's I mean, I don't know if you
Something
saw Radio
for the Boomers
did a couple years ago, the Radio Man piece based in Eric Hollenbeck's Vietnam work.
Yeah.
I would love to produce that again. I mean, that was a real powerful piece. Yeah.
Well, I look forward to the first time we see somebody write something in the paper saying that Long Shatter is a havoc on this community.
Yes, exactly. And and my daughter will call me and say, please don't. Yes.
Yeah. We've been through this before.
Yes. Yeah. Exactly.
Don't do it yet. No response.
Well, I think we're just about coming up on our time here, Michael, but it's been such a pleasure to talk to you and to hear the tales of Blue Lake and Del Arte and hear what you're working on now. And
fist fights of yesteryear.
Yes.
Thank you so much for
joining us. Thank you
both
so much for having this and doing this. And there are a million stories out there, you know.
We'll save those for the lager bar beer someday. And talk and listen to you more. But is there just any last thing you want to get out?
Well, just an encouragement to people. The festival's only 1 week and there's some COVID restrictions because of, you know, so it'll be less, we can't have full houses. So I would recommend people getting tickets early, and the website, delarte.com, the ticket page is working.
All right.
So excellent. It's working. You can get tickets.
Okay, good, good.
Excellent. It's early now because, and all the pieces will either be outside or in the tent, nothing in the Carlo, because we just feel that that's
true.
Probably not going to be possible quite yet.
Yes. Sure. Yeah.
Okay.
So,
okay.
And thank you so much for all the stuff that you guys do. So
thank you, Michael. Yeah. We will see you out at the Butterwatt Festival.
Yes.
Great. Look forward to it.
All right. Thank you so much.
Take good care.
Thanks.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Okay. Well, thank you so much to Michael Fields for sharing his stories of Blue Lake's rowdy past and telling us a bit about his time with his 45 years with Del Arte, and the best of luck to him with his new production company. I can't wait to check them out.
Let's go enjoy some vaccinated theater. What do you say?
Absolutely. Let's do it. I was going to ask you before you asked me. Let's go. We got to go to this show. Get yourself some tickets to Badawat Festival, formerly known as Mad River Festival. And you can find those at delarte.com for more information. I am right about that, right? It's delarte.com.
No. People know how to use the internet. If you're listening to a podcast, you know how to Google things.
One would assume, yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, anyway, Steph, get well, and see you all next week.
Bye bye.
Okay, Steph, so you've been telling me about Luna's Llama Adventures, whereby I can rent a llama to go hiking for a day or overnight. Mm-hmm. But let's say mm-hmm. I broke my legs on, how do I break my legs?
Well, if it's by the way that I usually fantasize it,
But let's say I've broken my legs, or maybe you've broken my legs because I've interrupted you on the podcast, as I tend to do. And I can't go hiking. Maybe I'm having a party, a celebration at my estate. And I want to spice it up a little.
You want to break your legs a little bit more.
Let's say I want to spice up my party with some llamas. Is that something that Luna's Llama Adventures would help me out with?
Why, Andrew, yes. Yes, it is. You're in luck, because after I have broken your legs, I am so kind as to bring some llamas to your party to say that I'm sorry. You can book a llama encounter for your next party or special event, and you will be the talk of the town, of whatever Humboldt town you live in, I guarantee. Check out lunasllamaadventures.com to find out more and book your llama visit or trek today.
I tell you, these llamas are really going to help me get over the violence that you've inflicted upon me. So I appreciate it.
Nothing says, sorry, I broke both of your legs, like a visit from a llama. Everybody knows that.
And add.